it's Diane. So great to be back with you. On my mind this week, it's been 1 year since the inauguration of President Trump. Earlier this week, I invited four top-notch political commentators for a panel discussion. I wanted to hear about how they thought our country had changed and get their perspective on many of the challenges ahead. In the studio with me, Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Juana Summers of CNN, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times joined us from a studio in New York. And here's our conversation. Norm, I'm going to start with you. Looking back on Donald Trump's first year, what do you think will stand out most in your memory?
In my memory, it is how all of the conditions in government designed to keep a presidency from careening out of control, from moving step by step towards things that are more autocratic, from preventing the kind of corruption inside the presidency, a kleptocracy, keeping government functioning at a reasonable level, have gone awry. And as much as anything, it's not just the president and even the president's administration. It's the Congress. Just reading the other day a catalog of the ways in which the president and his family have enriched themselves and foreign governments have fallen all over themselves to try and provide money for him so that they can get in his good graces or maybe use it in another way. Congress has held zero hearings on any of this. I look at some of the nominees who have been confirmed, judges and cabinet and subcabinet people, who didn't get the kind of vetting that we normally anticipate. And so I end up with some very profound concerns at the end of the year that go beyond simply Trump himself.
Juana, what about you?
I think one of the things that stands out most to me is how we've seen Donald Trump to some extent really redefine what the presidency is and what that means. I think part of that is through the fact that he relies so heavily on his instincts as a disruptor and kind of this freewheeling nature as someone who came from outside of government. But I think it's also partially because of his worldview and his view of what the office should be and should do. And I'll be really curious to see how that definition of the presidency and how Americans view the presidency bleeds into future years and President Trump's second term and beyond.
Byron.
Well, a couple of things. One, it's just obviously more contentious than it ever was, although it was pretty contentious in the Bush and Obama years. But the sheer level of acrimony is off the scale. And the second is kind of there's a two-tier presidency going on in the sense that Trump is always working on a couple of levels. On one level, there's the daily hair on fire controversy that he sets off and enjoys setting off. And on the other level, there's stuff his administration is doing that doesn't get a whole lot of news coverage. Actually, Politico has a very nice series. It's weekly. It says, you know, five things Trump did this week when you weren't looking. And the title of it basically says that these things don't get enough coverage. So there's always, and this was the same in the campaign as well, there's always this two-level thing going with him. And I think that's more of that than we've ever seen before.
What do you think we know about President Trump now that we did not know a year ago?
Well, there would be some critics who say we haven't learned anything about him. But I do think that those who thought he was going to act differently as president than he did in the campaign or that he did as a private businessman have been disabused of that notion. And they now believe that Trump is Trump, whatever office he is in.
You know, Diane, I've been in Washington almost 50 years, and I've had the privilege of getting to know most of the people who have been intimately involved in government, including a number of presidents. What's so striking to me is every one of them, the moment that it became clear that he had won the White House changed profoundly. And that included George Herbert Walker Bush, who'd had more experience than anybody you could have imagined, who'd been for the previous 8 years right there in the Oval Office when the decisions were being made. But all of a sudden, he was making the decisions, or would be. And he was responsible for everybody in the country, reached out to everybody. Donald Trump is the first president in that 50 years, and I would venture to say the first president in 150 years or more who was not changed one iota in fundamental personality by becoming president. He's governed the same way he campaigned, in a fashion that focuses on a tiny fraction of the country and tries to appease and inflame them and take on the rest of the country. It's really quite remarkable.
Maggie Haberman, I want you to weigh in on how much you think Trump has changed over this 1 year.
I don't think he's changed very much. I mean, I agree with various ways this has been put by others on this show. I think a lot of people expected who didn't either didn't know him well or who didn't cover or pay attention to the campaign very closely because they assumed Hillary Clinton would win, didn't really understand who he was or didn't focus on sort of anything deeper than whatever the daily headline was about him. And they assumed that a lot of it was an act. And this is who he is. Who he was in the campaign is who he is now. Who he was at Trump Tower over several decades is who he has been in office. I think that he has perhaps changed his understanding to some degree of what executive power actually means, because I think he came into office thinking that it was essentially going to be something like being a local clubhouse politician in New York, where he would have much more power than he did. And one of his advisors had told Glenn Thrush and me a while back that he used to speak sort of admiringly about the power that some of the local officials had when he was dealing with them as a real estate developer in New York. But I think that the magnitude of making decisions about other people's lives is something that he didn't I think internalizes more and sees more. But I think fundamentally he just is who he is. I don't think the office has changed him particularly. I think he's changed the office more than it's changed him.
And changing the office, he seems, or is it just my impression, that the mood in Washington has really been poisoned? It's non-functioning.
I think that it was, to be fair to him, I think it was heading in that direction for some time. I think that Byron is right that it was contentious under the last three presidencies. I don't think that the era of partisanship under when Bill Clinton was president was something that people think of warmly. Although you could still do sort of traditional deal making in Congress. The biggest concern, I think, is that the lack of agreement on a basic shared set of facts has very much reached Washington and very much reached government and the way it functions. And I don't know how you go back from that.
What about Congress? Republicans have control. What have they accomplished?
Sure. I think if you asked me to assess this in the first 6 to 8 months of full Republican control, I'd have a different answer. You saw Republicans in both chambers really struggle to control their own agenda, oftentimes at odds with what the White House wants and working in spite of it rather than in conjunction with it. But that said, I think that the 115th Congress comes away with a couple of big conservative wins. There's, of course, the long-promised rewrite of the tax code that they accomplish, the opening of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil exploration, number of lifetime judicial appointments. So they come away with a couple of big wins, but a really big to-do list for 2018 as well. And it's just not clear yet how successful they'll be there.
Byron, talk about the comments the president was alleged to have made last week and how that seemed to have taken us to a new low.
First of all, I need to ask your policy on four-letter words.
I think we are not going to do this.
Thank you very much. I asked for a ruling before that.
It's an eight-letter word, of course.
Well, okay. Well, I think, look, there's no doubt that, he used one of these terms.
One.
There was kind of a crazy hole versus house controversy.
Right.
That didn't really – there was no actual difference there. So he did use that. And look, I don't trust Senator Durbin to bring the whole context of the conversation out or the broader point that the president was trying to make. But his allies have – the president's allies have done that. So it sounded like a really heated, kind of ugly conversation about issues that actually are serious and legitimate. Which is what the American U.S. government's policy about admitting people into the country should be. And there's a lot of debate going on, perfectly reasonable debate going on. Should it all be country of origin? Should there be more merit-based immigration? What should the system look like? And so the president's vulgarities were actually part of that bigger debate.
No.
So a couple of points here, Diane. The first is one of my mentors was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And when he talked about defining deviancy down, it applies to almost everything in our politics today. Now with language, but even more with just the broader way in which you operate and how you deal with people. The second part of it is that you really do have people in the administration, starting with the chief of staff, John Kelly, who share a nativist and racially tinged, I would say. I would say that the president may be more racist approach towards immigration and immigrants. And it wasn't the language that was used. It was the context of this, talking disparagingly about nations that are mostly minority as opposed to those that are white.
Juana, I wonder how you saw the vulgarities the president has used and how you reacted.
Sure. I think that Norm hit the nail right on the head is that we've gotten into this fur and the reporting of this about what word was used, which of the 8-letter words. But this isn't about words. I think that for many people that I've spoken to and in this country, and we saw this reflected in Senator Cory Booker's response to this during a hearing with the Homeland Security Secretary, there's a lot of outrage here because they feel like they have there is a White House and a person in the White House, an administration that is pushing forward with policies that are inherently racist and that view white lives as more attractive to bringing into this country than lives of people of color. And I think for a number of people, they heard racism in the president's comments as they were reported. They heard classism. He's also making the argument that where you come from is kind of is important and shows what you can be, and that people who look like Senator Booker and myself and others are less desirable to be here. And I think for a lot of people, that's incredibly scary, quite frankly.
Maggie, what did you think about those Republicans who then said Senator Durbin was absolutely wrong?
Look, I think that we have seen this Rashomon-style response from different people who have attended meetings with this president, both when he was a candidate and since he's been in the Oval Office. There, a couple of hours after the initial Washington Post report by Josh Dossie, which used one very specific version of the word, Rich Lowry from National Review was on CNN, and he said that he had been told on good authority that it was a different word. It was house, not whole. And I still can't believe we're actually having this conversation. But what I took from it is that a couple of different things, but one of which is that I don't know that I see the distinction that the White House had been trying to make in those two words. And what I've heard since in my conversations with people about the context, he still fundamentally was comparing a country like Norway as favorable. A country like Norway has the distinction of being overwhelmingly white, and using a derisive term about heavily minority countries, heavily black countries. And he has trouble. He says these things, and then there's an utter resistance to hearing that people are offended by them. And this is not just a small number of people. This is now internationally a huge incident. And so I think it points back to a larger issue with this president, which is his inability to or seeming inability to experience empathy or look at how other people view things. And to your question, it reflects on how some allies of the White House who particularly who have what they see as shared policy goals, if not with the president himself, because candidly, I'm not really clear where he is on immigration at the moment, but certainly with some members of the White House staff. And those are the two tracks it functions on, the president and then the staff. They will do what they can, I think, to try to preserve an ultimate goal. And that was my takeaway.
You know, it's so interesting, Byron. Some 61% of Republicans think the country is moving in the right direction. How can that percentage be so high?
Well, because Trump has done a lot of things that conventional Republicans are quite happy with. Juana mentioned a couple of them. Toward the end of the year, we saw a number of assessments of Trump's first year in office, one of them by me. And it listed a bunch of things that Trump had done using his executive authority and that Congress had done. And basically it was tax cuts, deregulation, confirming a record number of judges to the circuit courts of appeal, getting out of the Paris Agreement. There's just a bunch of things that if any other Republican president who didn't have all these behavior issues, if any other Republican president had done them, Republican voters would be very happy with. And, of course, Democrats would oppose them if anybody else did them as well. So I think that partisan difference is not that difficult to figure out, because Trump has actually produced a number of things conservatives like.
So that means they're willing to overlook the kinds of racist or ugly comments.
Well, that was always the issue in the campaign among Republicans for whom Trump was not their first choice, but became their first choice after he won the nomination. There were some never Trump Republicans who say, look what he did. Look what he said about a war hero or about a judge of Mexican-American descent. Look what he did. And they would say, the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, and they decided to vote for Trump. So that is a calculation that Republicans have been making for more than a year now.
You know, there's a lot of ends justify the means theme to this. But it's interesting to me, Diane, that as we have been talking, Jeff Flake, who's retiring and who wouldn't have won re-election if he had run, is giving a speech on the Senate floor basically saying that Trump's reaction to the press has been Stalinesque, just like Stalin, and that using the term enemy of the people to refer to the press, which originated with Stalin, which Khrushchev, when he took over the Soviet Union, banned because it was too dangerous, is over the line. John McCain has taken the same position. The attacks on the judiciary, on the intelligence community. What I find so striking about Republicans is they're now joining in with the attack on the FBI and the intelligence community, which is dangerous for the country and for its role internationally. That you have so many people who have bought into Russia as our ally and are basically not doing the fundamental investigations. You have Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who has put, I would say, bluntly, country over party, but the wrong country. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I acknowledge what Byron said. There have been many things done, not many in Congress, and the tax bill was not the kind of fundamental reform, including many of the things that conservative intellectual tax policy people wanted in it. It was much more just a giant tax cut for corporations and a small tax cut for others. Much of it was done through the regulatory process and the Congressional Review Act, and it's going to have a profound effect on the country. But the larger effect of the decline or the demolition of norms in the society and in the political arena, some of those norms that enabled Trump to jam the appeals court with people because they'd blocked others before using the filibuster in unprecedented ways, those things we're not going to recover from for a long time. The policies may adjust, they may change, but there are a lot of bad things going on here that we simply have to acknowledge.
What about the Me Too movement? Do you think that that has been primarily a reaction to Donald Trump's behavior?
I think that's certainly a part of it, but I think it's important to keep in context that this is a movement we're seeing born out of, frankly, the fact that women are tired of being harassed or victims of misconduct across industries. But I think that, yes, there's clearly some of this. It's a response to President Trump. I think for many women that I interviewed prior to the president's election, right around the inauguration, it was really galling. By CNN's tally, more than 15 women have alleged that the president has engaged in some form of misconduct with them, from lewd activity all the way up to physical altercations. And I think that a lot of women find it very difficult to say that people knew about this. All of this was out there in the public consciousness, and yet Americans still elected this man president. So I think that he certainly emboldened that movement. And certainly we've seen from groups like Run for Something and Emily's List, some of these women born out of the Me Too movement are now, who are never political people, are going and seeking public office. And that part, I think, is certainly a reaction to this president and women being tired of seeing the way that this country is going right now.
Maggie, where are we with this constant refrain of fake news? How is that affecting public opinion?
Look, I think that he didn't invent the term fake news. He has used it, I think, very effectively, especially with his supporters, but he has used it to describe the way a lot of authoritarian leaders have in other countries, which is to describe any story, discredit stories and reporters who report on things they don't like, regardless of whether they're accurate. I think it's a dangerous term. And I think that you have seen some members of Congress, although not very many, talk about the need to halt such attacks. You had John McCain write an op-ed in the Washington Post about that very thing. But I think that where I think it comes from with the president is the press corps that he is very used to in New York City was tabloid in nature, pretty transactional, and mostly focused on celebrity or business, which is what he dealt with. Those are the sections he primarily dealt with. He is just fundamentally unused to the kind of reporting core that a government office comes with, whether it's a state house or a city hall or the presidency. And I just think he fundamentally doesn't understand what the White House press corps does. So when he sees coverage that doesn't match the reality as he sees it, he gets very frustrated and he yells fake news. But it has a very damaging effect, especially because for a lot of his supporters, they don't realize that he'll yell fake news and then he'll invite Reuters or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whomever into the Oval Office for an interview. His view of fake news is not consistent, and it's emotionally driven, and it emotionally goes away day by day.
How are we to define fake news at this point, Byron?
I don't think we need to actually define. I mean, maybe there is this category of something produced by a Russian bot that says there was a giant earthquake in Florida yesterday when there actually wasn't a giant earthquake in Florida yesterday. That you can certainly say. I think the way the president uses it, in part, he describes describing a bias that he sees in a lot of coverage, and actually, I do think, going back to the very first thing I said on this program about these two levels in Trump, that there is a daily hair-on-fire controversy. And I do think that he distracts a lot of the press corps, which gets its hair on fire about this comment or that comment, and devotes too much coverage on it relative to the other things that are going on in the government. And then the president denounces it all as fake news.
No. Just a couple of points. One is that it's a clear characteristic of autocracies that you try to redefine what truth is and turn it on its head. And this goes back a long ways, the 30s and even before that. But I think, you know, the other point here is that we have become tribal in so many ways. The book I did with E.J. Dionne and Tom Mann at One Nation After Trump, we talk about tribal media. And one of the things that's happened is we are increasingly cocooning into hearing what we want to hear. And that means that not only don't we share a common set of facts, we view any information coming from media other than those that we listen to and trust as fake news. And that's a really dangerous phenomenon for a society, for a democratic society.
Or something that's said about somebody we support that's negative that's viewed as fake news.
And we see that in a survey, actually, near a majority of Republicans say define as fake news something that's true but is negative about the other guy. One other element here, which is, as we also pointed out in the book, Donald Trump managed during the campaign and has since to fend off one scandal with another and another and another. So this last week, after Trump had said, getting back to the Me Too movement, that all of the women who had accused him were liars and he didn't know them anyhow. And it turns out that his lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid $130,000 to a porn star. Now there's a second porn star. And the idea that porn stars get payoff for blackmailing president is the fourth or fifth news story of the day or the week and hardly mentioned. Talk about defining deviancy down.
So people hearing you say that, Norm, are going to say, well, there goes Norm Ornstein again with fake news.
Sure they will. And what can you do about it? You know, where some of these things are documented and will be documented, even that won't matter very much. And where it will become particularly resonant, of course, is what happens with the Mueller investigation. And as we've already seen with the dossier, as it was called, no significant part of which has been disproved, but which a very substantial share of the public thinks was entirely fake. And then we have enablers of the president trying to bring a criminal charge against the guy who created it.
Will you describe briefly what was in that dossier that many people have heard about but don't understand?
So this started with a conservative organization during the primaries that didn't like Donald Trump hiring a firm, Fusion GPS, which had been created by former journalists to look into information about individuals and companies and groups. And they hired a former British MI5 intelligence officer who began to look around for things about Donald Trump and ended up finding from Russian sources a number of things that were deeply troubling about long-standing connections with Russia, financial and otherwise, and suggesting that they had all kinds of information about Trump, including some seamy stuff. Now, it was done by saying this is a raw data kind of thing. But when it got published, and the whole thing was published by BuzzFeed, and what started with a conservative news organization moved over to the Democratic Party during the course of the campaign, and it had any number of things in it. But so far, most of them have either been borne out or have not been disproven, and they are troubling elements about the connections between Donald Trump himself and Russia. And they're now the FBI, Steele, the man who did this, was alarmed enough by what he found, stumbling into it, that he went to the FBI and said, you really need to take a look at this.
Well, the dossier was filled with lots of actual details, which have not been verified publicly. If they've been verified privately, we don't know about it. For example, it did discuss these much-discussed sex parties that Donald Trump is alleged to have had in Moscow and another sex party, by the way, in St. Petersburg. It talks about Carter Page, who was this low-level, sometime foreign policy advisor of Trump, meeting in Moscow with a man named Igor Sechin, who was head of their giant energy company, who allegedly offered him millions and millions of dollars in exchange for lifting U.S. sanctions on Russia. I don't believe we've had any verification on that. It had Michael Cohen, the lawyer, again, meeting in Prague with Russians. We haven't had verification on that. And there's a lot more. There are actual details in this dossier.
Now a quick break.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria, Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville, Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. You're listening to a special panel discussion I had with four great guests, Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Juana Summers of CNN, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and Maggie Haberman of the New York Times. Maggie Haberman, President Trump says he plans to attend the meeting in Davos, Switzerland. That's a meeting for political and business leaders. In what ways have other governments adapted to working with the United States?
I mean, there have been various ways over the course of the year, and I guess I would say that we don't really know yet what message President Trump plans to deliver when he attends Davos. Recall that during the transition a year ago, Trump's aides said that they did not want to send a representative to Davos because it clashed with the populist message that he had run on a year later. The tax plan has been passed. It is going to be beneficial, the president claims, to many people, but among those who it will be beneficial to is very wealthy people and corporations and so forth. So I think he's coming with a different message this year. But what you've seen is governments use various methods both to try to get close to this administration and to try to make inroads with him and with his aides, and then to try to understand him. And Byron has talked a few times about two tracks. I think there's multiple tracks, one of which is the tweets, which send foreign leaders into fits of concern when they happen. I'd say that the alliance that has seen a fair amount of bruising is with the UK during the course of this over the last year because of the president's tweets. You've had the other leaders who have tried to sort of woo him, flatter him. They've studied up on him. But generally speaking, a lot of this work still takes place at the staff level. There are few foreign leaders with whom this president has forged a deep connection.
How do you see it, Byron?
Well, I think anytime there's a new president, obviously countries around the world try to figure out what the new president is going to do. You see a lot of that kind of activity in the transition. And this was just on steroids with Trump because he was so different and so unpredictable, and they were trying to figure him out. I do think that on a number of things, I go back to the national security strategy that H.R. McMaster, the head of the National Security Council, released a while back. It's a pretty solid conservative Republican strategy on dealing with the world's hotspots. Now, in addition, as Maggie said, you have these tweets. Let's just take the ones concerning North Korea that have set everyone's hair on fire and have seemed remarkably inflammatory, discussing nuclear war, which is something that in the past we never saw discussed casually by a president. So here again, on the one hand, you have a solid national security strategy produced by Trump's team. And then you have this my nuclear button is bigger than your nuclear button, which is true, but very, very surprising to hear a president talk about.
What do you think about that, Norm?
So first, Davos. There are going to be two things that I'll be looking for, assuming he goes. One is the direct reaction of leaders of other nations to his comments. The African Union issued a condemnation starker than anything they'd ever done before than we can imagine, and we've seen it from individual leaders. And we've seen other leaders, including the British Prime Minister, when the president recklessly tweeted something that had come from a crazy organization that everybody in Britain condemned, not handle it very well. But the second thing, which has gotten no attention, is he going to meet with Putin? Will there be a private little tete-a-tete with Vladimir Putin in Davos?
Do you think there will?
Yes, I do.
I do.
Now, the other part about this, though, other than we can talk about whether the national security strategy of McMaster is actually being implemented, I'm very disturbed by what's happened in the State Department, where the diplomatic corps has been hollowed out. And even just recently, the ambassador to Panama, one of our most distinguished career people, resigned, saying he couldn't handle it anymore. But what we also saw was just the other day, the president met with the head of Kazakhstan, one of the most vicious and kleptocratic dictators in the world, with effusive praise in a place where he's done all kinds of business. His friends in the world are people like Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, el-Sisi in Egypt, and the one person he has not criticized in even the slightest way, Vladimir Putin, while he's taken on almost all of our allies in one way or another. So this is another element, I think, of defining deviancy down. And if Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, and H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, can keep things under control, I'll sleep a little bit better at night. But as a general matter, I'm not real encouraged by what I see in our relations with the world.
Juana, we've been talking about what's happening around the world, but what about here? What's happening to the agencies that are supposed to be running our own country?
Absolutely. Earlier, I think you asked Maggie this question about the mood here in Washington. And I think the biggest thing I hear when I'm talking to folks who work in the agencies, particularly these folks who have been there for a long time prior to this administration, it's uncertainty. They feel that this administration and a number of the cabinet secretaries that President Trump has ushered in and that were confirmed by the Senate are reshaping what their agency's missions are. There's the report that more than 60% of the State Department career officials have been shed, which is certainly rather alarming. I think if you look at these agencies, I think the Justice Department may be the top example. Since Attorney General Jeff Sessions was confirmed, he's rescinded a slew of Obama-era policies relating to drugs, criminal justice, voting rights, rights for LGBTQ people in this country. And that's just one example of where there's really important work that's happening and a lot of change that's happening. And I think that most Americans don't necessarily know what's going on and don't get the sense of that for a variety of reasons, many of which is because it's so easy to kind of get caught up in whatever the scandal or crisis of the day is.
And that's exactly what you were talking about, Byron.
They're doing a lot. Jeff Sessions is doing a lot. He doesn't get much thanks from it from the president but he is actually doing a lot. The EPA is doing a lot. And here again, I just want to stress that some of the things that Juana was talking about, these are things that conservative Republicans are happy to see being done by the agencies. And to the degree that the agencies are becoming smaller through attrition, they're happy to see that too.
Yeah. Now, Maggie, Democrats have been putting a lot of hope into the 2018 elections. Should they?
Yes. All polling done by reliable pollsters in both sides, private pollsters, or pollsters who are conducting polling privately as opposed to what we see publicly, predict that this is going to be, again, things could change. There is a lot of time left. But at the moment, they see no path for Republicans to hold the House. They're less concerned about the Senate, but they are, because the map favors Republicans. But there are concerns there, too, and there is an enormous sense of frustration among members of Congress who have to run for re-election or those who you know, were thinking of trying it out and then decided not to, that the president still has a pretty solid base of about 30% of the GOP electorate. Those are people who do not want to see candidates distance themselves from the president, criticize him. On the other hand, the president's doing nothing to bring in independents, and his remarks end up being – and his tweets and so forth end up being something that everybody has to comment on and decide what to do with every day. It's – you know, I remember when in 2010 when President Obama openly supported a mosque project that was being built near Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan – And most local officials, most local Democrats in New York were very upset that he did that, though they did not say that publicly. Those who were running for election that year would have rather not have to weigh in on it themselves. And that is obviously a very different type of issue than a lot of what this president weighs in on. But take that and amplify it three times a day, that the leader of your party is saying something that you then have to, you know, give an up or down answer on and either distance yourself from or cling to. It is a difficult climate. You know, the White House is very proud of the tax bill having passed, and they certainly put a lot of work into it. But the reality, if you talk to members of Congress, is that this was an act of self-preservation by a GOP that needed to have something to show for single-party rule.
So, Norm, writing in The Atlantic, Jim Fallows pointed out what would happen if just two, any two, Republican senators decided to take a stand in this dangerous moment in politics. Where would we be?
That's definitely the case. I had a conversation conversations with three Republican senators who voted for the tax bill. And I said I was disappointed because there were 15 Democrats lined up, including Chris Coons of Delaware, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and many others, ready to do a broader, more constructive bipartisan tax bill. That would have been an enormous triumph for the country, but also would have been good for almost everybody else. And a couple of them called the White House before the vote and said, "We've got this bipartisan coalition. We can get 65 votes." And what they were told was, and they got the same reaction from Mitch McConnell, "We've got the votes. We don't need them." So there's been, I think, a conscious strategy where you can to get your votes where you want them. And certainly, as Byron would say, the tax bill that passed has been widely applauded by most Republicans out there. But it leaves them in a position where they can do almost nothing else. And, the other phenomenon here, which is an interesting one in the House, where they have a somewhat larger majority, but it reminds me of what Ronald Reagan once said, which is in his White House, sometimes the right hand doesn't know what the far right hand is doing, that you have two groups of conservatives in the House. You don't have any moderates. I mean, the closest you come, Charlie Dent is leaving, and many of those who are retiring are the ones who would want to be problem solvers. But the Freedom Caucus bedevils the leadership on a regular basis. And there are times when they're not going to get those votes when they need Democrats. And Trump is making it harder for that to happen. And we're facing another crunch point in terms of a potential shutdown of the government.
Exactly.
And we're going to have those kinds of crises through the course of the next year. A dynamic after 2018 where it's more likely to have a Democratic House and probably a nearly evenly divided Senate is going to make for more dysfunctional politics and policymaking.
Byron.
Well, you know, you mentioned if there were only two senators who would – Republican senators who would change their stand on this, there being – after the disaster in Alabama, just 51 Republican senators, each of them has to make a decision with each one of these bills, which basically embody the things that they've been trying to enact for much of their career. Do they vote against it because they don't like Donald Trump? They're just not going to do that. If Mitt Romney becomes a senator from Utah, he's going to come to Washington. He's going to keep his distance. He'll distance himself from Trump. He'll criticize Trump, and then he'll vote with Trump 90%+ of the time.
Do you agree with that, Juana?
I think that it's very likely that Byron is correct. We haven't heard Mitt Romney even commit to saying that he's going to run yet. But I think that the political climate there is very fraught. If I recall correctly, President Trump won Utah, but with less share of the electorate than in the last for presidents last like 20 years or something like that. So I think one of the biggest unanswered questions is what will Mitt Romney do? He's someone who kind of has always been, as someone who covered him, kind of above the muck of the politics, or has positioned himself as such. So whether or not he will stand up as a force against the president, or as Byron suggests, vote along with him, though maybe not vocally side with him, I think is going to be really interesting.
You know, what I found so interesting so far is how Republicans in the Senate have gone along with so many things, including many that left them a little uneasy, and that includes many confirmations. At least a couple of judges who were unanimously or near unanimously ruled as unqualified by the American Bar Association. What struck me during the discussion over cabinet members was less Jeff Sessions, who had been a senator, but Scott Pruitt, who under oath to the Senate said that none of the emails, private emails that he had put out when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma had anything to do with business. And we had a judge ruling that those emails would come out on a particular day. And Mitch McConnell pushed through that confirmation 2 days beforehand. And afterwards, we learned that he had lied to the Senate. And the willingness to go along with those things, the kind of tribalness that we see in those areas, is itself striking and something that I think is not what we would have seen with previous presidents.
Maggie, earlier we heard about the Mueller investigation. What happens to whatever turns up in that investigation if Democrats don't retake the House?
It's a great question, and it is one of the unknowns. At the moment, the end date for this investigation is a little uncertain. Among other things, it's possible that Mueller could end up wrapping up the major thrust of this probe, which is Russia-related, but then keep the office going for a while to tie up any loose ends, which is similar to what we've seen in the past with special prosecutors' offices. So there are a range of possibilities. I think that what Mueller is trying to do is get the vast bulk of this work done, certainly by mid-year. He is mindful of the political climate in both directions. You saw that in his request for the trial of Rick Gates and Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, deputy campaign chairman, who have been indicted. He was hoping to have that trial in, I think it was May, and a judge dismissed that request, and it's going to be closer to the elections. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a desire to get this done soonish. The longer it goes on, the more there is a partisan tinge to it, and then it heads into, as you note, pretty uncertain territory. I also think, look, there's a big debate, and I would just one thing I would add. The president had been warned over the course of this past year by his advisors that if he created a climate or added to a climate where Democrats could retake the House, that he would be impeached almost immediately. We have to wait and see. Some Democrats don't want that, but it's certainly hovering out there.
Well, it's been a great hour. And I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Norm Ornstein, the American Enterprise Institute, Juana Summers of CNN, Byron York, the Washington Examiner, and Maggie Haberman of the New York Times. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Allison Brody, with help today from Robbie Gould. Our engineer is Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.